There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, 1207 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this September 11th, 18 year since the attack on our country, remembering 9/11 today, as we did this morning, through the words of our leaders, also through what you have to say. And phone lines and text lines are open for that throughout the next 2 hours of live local talk at 343-0106. In a second, we'll get to audio of President Trump today speaking at the Pentagon. Also, Vice President Mike Pence spoke at Shanksville in western Pennsylvania.
They had no way of knowing, those 40 remarkable men and women, that within 81 minutes from takeoff, their lives would be over. They would enter eternity. But not before they had earned a place of honor in the annals of American history and in the hearts of every American.
I don't know if you saw, if you're on Twitter, if you follow me on Twitter, at FM Talk 106.5, you need to check out the some pictures I put up there from about 2 years ago. I guess maybe just last year. A friend and I were up in that area of Pennsylvania and went over to the Flight 93 Memorial there in Shanksville. And number one, the pictures don't do it justice, as the cliche goes. But as well, if you're anywhere in that part of the country, you need to go by there and see what goes on inside that museum, the personal artifacts that were dug from the wreckage there in Shanksville from the 40 passengers and crew that died there as they heroically fought off the terrorists that were bent on putting that plane into the White House. Vice President Pence speaking there today. President Trump speaking at the Pentagon today. Here's the audio of that. This happened about 2.5 hours ago.
Well, thank you very much, Secretary Esper. Today, our nation honors and mourns the nearly 3,000 lives that were stolen from us on September 11th, 2001. On these grounds, 184 people were murdered when Al-Qaeda terrorists overtook American Airlines Flight 77 and crashed it into the Pentagon. For every American who lived through that day, the September 11th attack is seared into our soul. It was a day filled with shock, horror, sorrow, and righteous fury. I vividly remember when I first heard the news. I was sitting at home watching a major business television show early that morning. Jack Welch, the legendary head of General Electric, was about to be interviewed when all of a sudden, they cut away. At first, there were different reports. It was a boiler fire. But I knew that boilers aren't at the top of a building. It was a kitchen explosion in Windows on the World. Nobody really knew what happened. There was great confusion. I was looking out of a window from a building in Midtown Manhattan, directly at the World Trade Center, when I saw a second plane at a tremendous speed go into the second tower. It was then that I realized the world was going to change. I was no longer going to be and it could never, ever be that innocent place that I thought it was. Soon after, I went down to Ground Zero with men who worked for me to try to help in any little way that we could. We were not alone. So many others were scattered around trying to do the same. They were all trying to help. But for the families who join us, this is your anniversary of personal and permanent loss. It's the day that has replayed in your memory 1,000 times over. The last kiss, the last phone call, the last time hearing those precious words, "I love you." Then the attack, the anguish of knowing your family member had boarded one of these flights or was working in the World Trade Center or serving right here at the Pentagon. You waited, you prayed, you answered that most dreaded call, and your life changed forever. To each of you, the First Lady and I are united with you in grief. We come here in the knowledge that we cannot erase the pain or reverse the evil of that dark and wretched day. But we offer you all that we have, our unwavering loyalty, our undying devotion, and our eternal pledge that your loved ones will never, ever be forgotten. 18 years ago, the terrorists struck this citadel of power and American strength. But the enemy soon learned that they could not weaken the spirit of our people. In times of distress, the heart of the American patriot only grows stronger and more determined. Even in the midst of the attack, the world witnessed the awesome power of American defiance. 40 passengers and crew on Flight 93 rose up, fought back, and thwarted the enemy's wicked plans. In their final moments, these American heroes thunderously declared that we alone decide our fate. We saw American perseverance in the valiant New York firefighters, police officers, first responders, military, and everyday citizens who raced into the crashing towers to rescue innocent people. One such American was retired Army Colonel Rick Rescorla, who gave his life on 9/11. Rick earned the Silver Star and the Purple Heart for his service in Vietnam. He later became the Vice President for Security at Morgan Stanley in the World Trade Center. On the day of the attack, Rick died while leading countless others to safety. His selfless actions saved approximately 2,700 lives. Today, I'm honored to announce that we will soon be awarding the late Rick Rescorla the Presidential Citizens Medal for his extraordinary sacrifice. Though Rick has left this earth, we will ensure that the memory of his deeds will never, ever be forgotten. His memory will forever endure. Thank you. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Rick. Here on the western side of the Pentagon, we saw brave men and women rush into the fire and race into the scorching flames to rescue their colleagues. When evil seeks to do us harm, the incredible men and women of the United States military answer with unyielding valor and unstoppable resolve. Navy Admiral David Thomas crawled through live wires and helped lift a wall of debris to save the life of a colleague. As Admiral Thomas remembers, "It was the worst day of my life, but the heroism and selfless disregard I saw that horrible morning is forever burned in my heart. Admiral Thomas, America salutes you and every patriot who defied evil that day. Thank you very much, Admiral. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Army Ranger Chris Brayman repeatedly went back inside the burning building, rescuing one injured person after another. Before he entered, he said a prayer and asked God to give him strength, and then he dove into the suffocating smoke and fumes and flames. At the same time, Sheila Moody had just prayed that someone would find her. Then she heard Chris's voice. As Sheila says, God sent Chris as her guardian angel. To Sheila and Chris, America is strengthened by your goodness and your grace and your bravery. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. To fulfill our unbreakable promise to every survivor and family of 9/11, earlier this year, we fully reauthorized the Victims Compensation Fund to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. Since September 11th, nearly 6 million young men and women have joined the United States Armed Forces. They have crossed seas, climbed mountains, trekked through deserts, and rushed into enemy compounds to face down the threat of radical Islamic terrorism. Nearly 7,000 service members have laid down their lives to protect our home, our flag, and our American way of life. American freedom survives only because there are patriots willing to sacrifice everything in its defense. No tribute is sufficient to convey the infinite depth of our nation's gratitude. On this solemn day of remembrance, our thoughts also turn to the 200,000 valiant soldiers, sailors, airmen, Coast Guardsmen, and Marines who are now at this very moment stationed overseas. We do not seek conflict, but if anyone dares to strike our land, we will respond with the full measure of American power and the iron will of the American spirit, and that spirit is unbreakable. We had peace talks scheduled a few days ago. I called them off when I learned that they had killed a great American soldier from Puerto Rico and 11 other innocent people. They thought they would use this attack to show strength, but actually what they showed is unrelenting weakness. The last 4 days, we have hit our enemy harder than they have ever been hit before, and that will continue. And if for any reason they come back to our country, we will go wherever they are and use power the likes of which the United States has never used before. And I'm not even talking about nuclear power. They will never have seen anything like what will happen to them. No enemy on earth can match the overwhelming strength, skill, and might of the American armed forces. And we have rebuilt and strengthened in the last 2.5 years, spending $700 billion, $716 billion, and now just approved $738 billion, more money by far than ever spent on our armed forces. You are the fearless sentinels who stand watch over all that we cherish and everything we hold sacred, priceless, and dear. This morning, we also give thanks to the dedicated men and women at the Department of Homeland Security. Their department was created after 9/11 to help secure our immigration system and ensure that those who threaten our people are denied entry to our shores. We're indebted to every law enforcement official, state, local, and federal, who devotes their life to keeping America safe. As we gather at this moment and at this incredible memorial, we are reminded that there is no greater testament to our fallen heroes than the presence of their families who knew and loved them so much. Among the family members here today is Stephanie Dunn. Her husband, Navy Commander Patrick Dunn, was one of the patriots who gave his life right here 18 years ago. Before he left that morning, Patrick gave Stephanie a big, beautiful kiss. Then, for the first time, he leaned down and kissed her pregnant stomach. Stephanie was just 2 months along with their first child. Earlier this year, their daughter Allie celebrated her 17th birthday. Allie grew up into a strong, truly remarkable young woman. She mentors the children of our nation's wounded warriors. And recently, I was honored to give Allie the President's Volunteer Service Award for her hundreds of hours of community service. We are blessed to have Allie here with us at today's ceremony. Thank you, Allie. Thank you. Thank you, Kelly. And Allie, I know your dad is watching over you. He's right up there. He's watching from heaven, looking down right now with love and pride. He is so proud of you. Thank you very much. Incredible. Also joining us is the Vigiano family. For generations, the Vigiano family has served in our military and in the New York City Fire and Police Departments. These are two great departments. I grew up with them, I know. On September 11th, NYPD Detective Joseph Vigiano rushed into the World Trade Center and died rescuing his fellow citizens. His brother John was a New York firefighter. He also gave his life that day at Ground Zero. At the time, Joseph's three sons were just young boys, ages 8, 6, and 3 months old. This morning, they are with us. The youngest, John, just started his freshman year of college at SUNY Maritime College, and he plans to join the military. Joseph Jr. is a Marine reservist, and just like his father, he is a proud member of the NYPD. And James is a corporal in the Marines. On his last deployment, James was stationed on the USS New York, a ship made using 24 tons of steel from the World Trade Center. Every time he left the mess hall on his way to his bunk, he passed a picture of his dad. To John, Joseph, and James, and to the Vigiano family, you have sacrificed beyond measure, and you will never, ever stop giving back to this country. And thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Very proud of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. The heroes present today remind us of an immortal truth. The future of our nation is secured through the vigilance of our people. The brave men and women who tore through the gates of hell to save the hurt and the wounded. The service members who honor the friends who perished by continuing their exceptional life of service. The moms and dads who endure the loss of their soulmates and fill their children's lives with all of the adoration in the world. The sons and daughters who suffered grave loss and yet through it all persevere to care for our neighbors, defend our homeland, and safeguard our nation. Each of your lives tells the story of courage and character, virtue and valor, resilience and resolve.
All right, as we wrap it up with the president's comments today from the Pentagon. Coming back, more of Midday Mobile. I want to hear from you. Hey, one question. I started thinking about this. The war on terror, right? As I pointed out today, a day to remember those lost 18 years ago, but all the lives that have been lost since in the war against terror. War, by definition, to many of us, is something that has a time frame. It could be long, but it's a finite time frame, right? It's got a beginning, it's got a middle, it's got an end. Does this?
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
At 12:28, FM Talk 106.5. And it is Midday Mobile on this solemn anniversary of the attacks of 9/11 and the 18 years of the war against terror. Brian said on the text line, thanks, Brian, he said, I think the word you're looking for is a clear objective. You know, I don't know, Brian, actually, that's, I don't think so. I think the objective is clear in this situation. The objective is to fight terror, but it's, to me, and this is a discussion I want to have. This is not soapbox stuff. This is us talking. And it's when we engage, whether it would have been, pick a war that we've been in. Even some that you say, well, they're not as clear cut, but they had a nation state to defeat, right? I mean, you could say, well, we had a fight against communism. That was an idea. That was not, but it manifested itself through the Cold War in nation states. Even for right or for wrong, the wars were made between nation states, even though the undercurrent may have been an idea. In this case, terrorism, and in the case we're talking about here, Islamic extremism, is something that can move. But if it's a war against terror, we don't care. That's one thing I would like to turn the argument around that's been made forever. Hey, the United States doesn't care. It's not that they said, oh, well, now we're going to fight terrorism because it's Islamic extremism. That's who attacked us on 9/11. If it would have been some other group with some other ideology, we would be in war against them right now, too. Okay? So, going forward, this war against, I see it as being almost a constant war. And I guess it still can fit the definition of war. But it's one that is a same way you would work to keep something at bay more than, because you could never defeat an ideology if it would pop up somewhere else. I want to hear from you about this when we get back at 343-0106. Appreciate your texts and calls. We're coming right back. News is next. And by the way, Dr. Bill's forecast coming up too.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
By the way, check us out online, fmtalk1065.com. Top stories of the day, show schedules for weekdays, weekends, podcasts there, online opinion poll questions, a whole lot more. And check it out, fmtalk1065.com. Just for a second, on a lighter note here, Dalton, this question is for all of us out there, really the guys. Although ladies, I guess you can chime in on this. I'm looking at this shirt here, a new shirt. It's a relaxed fit, it says on the label. Relaxed fit. Is relaxed fit the new, is that the PC term for husky? Is that the new husky? Is relaxed fit? Because, see, I got a lot of stuff that's relaxed fit these days. Is it a relaxed fit shirt here? Relaxed fit. I don't know. Is that the, maybe this is the new, you don't hear husky anymore. Maybe the new euphemism is, well, it's, you know, he's kind of relaxed fit. Let's go to the phones, and I hadn't talked to this man in quite a while, my buddy Buck Allen. Hey, man.
Afternoon, sir.
Afternoon. How are you?
Man, I am mostly sunny this afternoon. Good. We made it through halfway through the week. Woohoo!
That's right. You and I have been talking a long time on these solemn anniversaries of 9/11. You know, we've been doing this over the years, man.
Yep. Absolutely. That happened on I want to say it was a Tuesday morning. We were there on a Thursday morning on a confined space rescue team out of South Mississippi, MERTAC. It was, So, yeah, I would love to get in on this conversation.
Absolutely.
About terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, and kind of this question, and it's not that, and people on the text line, some people I think understand what I'm asking, some people haven't. This is no question. I'm in full support of our troops. I'm in full support of the objectives. I'm just saying, if we use the term war, maybe it's just how we've been educated over time, you know, whether through school or through reading or whatever. A war has this beginning, middle, and end. We're always looking for the end, right, of a war. When's the end? When's the armistice? There might not ever be one in this.
I don't see how there can be, for the simple fact that if you look at the globe, right, Southeast Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and global money being dumped in to hating anything other than itself, speaking of Islam, where we were going to Nigeria, Lagos, Nigeria, and 2 days before we got there, there was 130 Christians killed. And you don't hear about that, but it happens every day all over the world to Christians, even Christians that live in those countries.
Sure.
Christians, they aren't just killed, but they're enslaved.
And you look at this and you wonder, that can be in Lagos, Nigeria, but it's not like the ideology is specific to one country. I mean, we can look at horrible, look at World War II and look at the rise of the Nazis, but you had a geographic area to take over, to control, and to rid it of that menace. That, you know, that was an ideology that was tied to a nation state, where it's not Islam in general, but specifically radical Islam, that there's not a specific, it's just this country. If you go occupy this country, which I don't want us doing anyway, but if we got to go occupy this country, that doesn't solve it. It goes elsewhere. Look what happened with ISIS.
Well, exactly. And I work with Muslims, with a couple of Muslims, and I'm not anti-Muslim by any means. They're not all Muslims are bad people. It's the radical Islam. It's the people that are absolutely racist or evil, that hate anything other than themselves. So I'm not saying Islam is horrible, because I've known plenty of good Muslims. However, consider the global money. Hamas would be one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Consider the Palestinian state that runs cartoons that consider you and I the infidel, and that we're evil just in our basic existence.
Think about this. Let's bounce this. If, you know, there's a talk right now because Benjamin Netanyahu has promised, if reelected, he'll occupy some of the Jordan Valley there. You could physically take over every bordering area it's an incubator for Hamas, and you wouldn't get rid of Hamas. I guess that's what I'm getting to. The old idea of physical geography and war that is the constraint of the 20th century, if we try to put the definition of this 18-year war against terror and say, okay, well, it's going to end soon because we'll accomplish the security in this zone or that zone, I don't know that we'll ever get that. And if we look for that, I think we'll never have satisfaction.
It's not possible. You can't control the way I feel or think or what I believe. And that's what you're up against.
There we go. Buck, as always, man, I appreciate our conversations. You be safe.
Yes, sir.
All right, and I want to talk to, you know, I talked to this man a whole bunch, and usually we're talking about the toll or Common Core or something, but what the day job for this man is teaching, and teaching on the subjects we're talking about right now. Dr. Lou Campomenosi joins us now to talk about the war on terror. Hey, Dr. Lou.
Hey, Sean. Really good conversation. It's just, this question of not having geographic boundaries, it's not new in a sense, though, when you look at what happened during the Cold War. The ideological aspects of the Cold War were quite real, but at the same time, there were issues pertaining to where you had to draw the line about communist expansion. So you have Korea, you have Vietnam, two examples that demonstrated that the use of force was necessary. And again, we can get into questions about Vietnam and all like that. I understand that. But the point is, from the standpoint of the paradigm associated with the Cold War, we needed to be able to fight on the ground if necessary. So
sure.
you have this kind of ideological, you know, capitalism versus, you know, communism issue, which to a very large degree, intellectually at least, one could argue that the failure of communism as a demonstrated way of doing, you know, the kinds of things that they promised, it was such an abject failure that we won that without too much trouble, really. But nevertheless, no, isn't it interesting that professors out of Duke University about 10 years ago were talking about how, well, you know, Marx was really right, but it's just never applied correctly. And you have that kind of thinking now, and you see, certainly see it with this modern Democratic Party going so far to the left with AOC and all these folks. So you really kind of wonder, you know, did we really win intellectually when you see these people doing what they're trying to do? But as it stands, for what I've put out to our people on Common Sense today, I think there are two lessons that have been learned about what's necessary in this war on terror, however you want to define what it is. And one of them is that you've got to have cognizance of what the threat is and to move on it quickly before it metastasizes into something worse. I use the example of Bill Clinton. He basically did not listen to his counterterrorist guru, Richard Clark. Clark was pulling his hair out, trying to tell Clinton, Al-Qaeda is an existential threat. We have to deal with it. Well, I mean, Clinton being Clinton, I think he had his mind on other things, in my view, but nevertheless, he finally awoken to the threat with the Kenyan bombings and you know, the two African bombings caused him to take a more serious look at Al-Qaeda. But between 1998 and 2000, when the coal destroyer was attacked, we really didn't do too much. Even after the coal bombing, which everyone knew was Al-Qaeda, Clinton did not want to go after Al-Qaeda. Now,
let me ask a question here and say, and just play devil's advocate for a second. That's got to be a heavy lift, though, because when you talk about Al-Qaeda or, you know, any of the offshoots of Al-Qaeda, it's not like you can address the specific nation state. You know, you can say, hey, they're existing in your country, but they're not exactly the regular army of that given country where you can say, we're going to sit down at the table, we're going to work this out, or we're going to declare war against your country. It's a lot harder to say this amorphous thing that can move from country to country and from place to place we're declaring war against.
Well, I mean, that's true. But in this particular case with Afghanistan harboring Al-Qaeda, sure. I mean, that was the issue. And for Clinton, he was just really afraid of sending missiles that could have had collateral damage. It just got to be too much of a problem for him. And even after the coal bombing in October on the eve of the election of 2000, he did not want to go down that road. And so, you know, Clark was just absolutely beside himself. And then when Bush got to office, well, I mean, that's the first thing Clark said. This is an existential threat. We have got to do something about it. And what you end up seeing is that Bush, and you see, I mean, look, Clark was very much anti-Bush in the commission hearings, okay, the 9/11 commission hearings. But when you really look at what Bush tried to do, and again, I'm getting into the weeds here, but the bottom line is Bush took action against Al-Qaeda that Clinton never really did, okay? Clinton waited, listened, didn't act. Bush took it upon himself, told in April of 2001, told National Security Advisor, I want a plan to go after, you know, Al-Qaeda. And that plan, unfortunately, was ready on the 10th of September. That plan was never briefed because schedules changed, and the next day you know what happened. But my point here is that the lesson is you don't wait for threats to metastasize. And so the contemporary issue, in my view, is the Iranians. From a standpoint of radical jihadists, I mean, they fit the bill completely. This is what they do every Friday, chanting death to America, death to Israel. And I would say, at least on Trump's behalf, he's got that part of the equation taken care of. The second major lesson that I've concluded on here is that political leadership has got to have the strength and the courage to do what's necessary. I give credit to George Bush, and we can argue all day long about the wisdom of going into Iraq. But when it came to the point where lots of people were telling him to retreat, he doubled down, had the surge, and he prevailed. Nixon did the same thing when Vietnam was a major problem in 1972 during the Easter Offensive. Nixon's advisors were saying, this is their problem, the Vietnamese, we've done everything we can. Nixon said, no, I will not use the word he used, but we're not going to let these bees, you know, defeat us. And he doubled down on what was necessary, rebombed North Vietnam, mined Haiphong, diplomatically, astutely broke, you know, with the relationship with Hanoi and the Soviet Union over issues the Soviets wanted. And here again, we get back to, you know, what Trump has done. He has moved in the right direction in terms of China, North Korea, and Russia. I would argue, and this is where you get into this inside baseball business about, you know, Trump and Bolton not agreeing. And that is an issue. But on many of these issues, Trump has been okay. But I would argue that Bolton and Mattis were both more correct on this issue of Syria, because Obama left us with a situation where the Russians and the Iranians in Syria are now threatening to be able to do what the Russians have not been able to do in 45 years, and that's have a warm water port along with major influence in a strategically important place with Syria. And the ramifications of it are all along the lines of what the Israelis are going to do, because they are, and again, we've seen this with the Israelis going after the Iranian forces in Syria and in Lebanon. I mean, and again, we get back to the necessity of a geographic assessment here. So I think that those two lessons are the critical thing going forward for us. So whether it's ideology or whether it's other things, if you see people who are gathering in bad guy country, then you go after them. You hurt them as much as you can. Doesn't mean we have to invade, but it certainly means that we don't sit by and watch them get better, you know, better able. And this is exactly the problem with Obama. 2014, September of, you know, he says things along the lines, we're going to go after ISIS. Well, the predicate to that was that he called ISIS the JV team. Didn't matter. Well, within a short period of time, ISIS had taken Mosul, the second major city in Iraq, and you know the rest of the story in developing the caliphate. Right. He waited, he dithered. That's the problem.
Well, and also you look at a region where nationality is not that important. You talk about Iraq. I mean, they're cobbled together. They're a creation of a nation,
right.
and so allegiance, you know, really falls with whoever is the most powerful person or group rolling into your city. So you leave a void, and somebody will fill that void. And I get it. And you and I probably disagree on some things, the amount of interaction outside our borders. But I think the bigger question, I think most Americans would agree that you have to fight this. Terrorism in wherever it rises. And I guess the problem is politically, that's not a war that has it's not a war that's going to have a confetti parade, a ticker tape parade. We're not going to have the famous picture of the soldier, you know, the sailor kissing his girlfriend there on the streets. You know, we're not going to have a VE Day or VJ Day. We're not going to have that. And I think politically, that's something very hard to deal with, because the American people are expecting some end. And I look at this, and it's a job we have to do, but the war against terror having this finite period in this, okay, now it's over. I don't think we're not going to see that. I hope we would, but I don't think we do. Not in my lifetime.
Well, I think you're right about that. The aspect of this is that it is amorphous. It seems endless, and that does create a different, you know, approach that has to be taken. But I do think that this is where, you know, political leadership's got to step up. And as I suggested, Trump has done quite well in certain areas. And then we can argue about whether or not he should go have a bromance with Kim Jong-un. But on the other hand, when he came to office, look what was going on. I mean, you know, and then we deployed more forces, another carrier strike force over there. It looked like we were going to have a major military confrontation, and all of a sudden, diplomacy starts to work. And again, you know, this is something that Mattis pointed out, and again, he was on Fareed Zakaria's show on Sunday. And Mattis basically said diplomacy has got to be based on a position of strength. And that's exactly right. We've learned that over and over again. And what Trump did saying no to the Taliban, you know, because what they have been doing, and I think, you know, you and I may have had this conversation. I know I've said it on my radio show for the past 6 weeks, that this whole business of what we're trying to do with negotiating with the Taliban, while they continue to have terrorist attacks, killing Americans, killing innocent people, does not bode well for any kind of negotiations. We are in a weak position, and it looks like, well, all we are is on a green light to get out of Afghanistan, which I personally think would be a major mistake, and which is even Obama put a stop to it. He started taking people out, and by the time he got down to 6,000, he finally decided, well, that's too low, so they put, you know, 6,000 more in there. But here again, we get back to terrorism, you know, counterterrorism, and what's necessary to do that. And I think that, you know, that it's incumbent upon Trump to lay out a definitive plan that basically says, look, it's a long war. We know who the enemy is. We're not going to allow them to pop up here. So whether it's Boko Haram, whether it's ISIS, whether it's Al-Qaeda, they are in our sight. And we'll go after them and do whatever we have to do to keep them from going forth. But at the same time, I think here again, we have missed the boat on this. Moderate Muslims are out there, whether it's Hirsi Ali, whether it's Nuri Zatzer. These people are not the radical Islamists. Unless we can find a way to have Islam have its own reformation, then we're going to be playing whack-a-mole for a long time. That's really what it falls down to.
That is it. And I think maybe we're up against a break here, but the new policy that the Roosevelt 2.0 is going to be for President Trump. I was thinking about this the other day. Speak loudly and carry a big stick.
Yeah.
Something like that.
You know, if it comes, there's nothing wrong with that.
That's about where we're at. And Dr. Liu, every day, and especially on this day, thank you for your service to our nation.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate what you do to keep people informed. I'll tell you, that's 90% of the battle today, the information war.
We're trying. That's for sure.
You do more than try. You do it. You nail it. So
thank you, Lou. I appreciate it. Hey, I appreciate you, Dr. Lou Campomenosi, joining us. And we're coming right back to wrap up this hour on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Okay, about to wrap it up for this hour. A couple of people asking about Dr. Lou. Yeah, he's a academic doctor, professor of political science. It's his specialty, so that's why we're getting into the discussion of what was is his bread and butter, and that is talking about the war against terrorism, and that discussion will continue. I don't think we're done with that anytime soon. That was kind of my move here in my discussion of 18 years since the attacks on our country, that we will be, I'm afraid, in this war of some sorts, maybe hotter and colder, different times for the rest of our lives. I hope not, but I feel that is the truth. All right, coming up next hour, Gabe Tynes from Landyap joins us. Whole lot of shaking going on in Fairhope. We'll talk about it with him next.